I'm Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporina of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories. Hello and welcome back to this week's episode of the On Air podcast. I am just going to straight away apologise for my very croaky voice.
Oh, I like it. It's quite husky.
I know, it's just husking it all over the place. But we have got a more traditional episode for you this week because the royals have actually been doing things, which is always nice. And we thought we would start on a happy, positive note and talk about the recent state visit to the UK, which came from South Africa.
Yes, so this is the first state visit to the UK since the Queen's death. I think it was delayed. It was supposed to happen when the Queen was alive, but it was delayed, I think.
Most other sort of European monarchies started having state visits again, kind of from the start of this year and certainly from the middle of this year. And then it was very kind of, I think everyone was expecting there to be a UK one announced in the autumn. And then obviously when the Queen died, everyone was like, well, they're a bit busy right now. So I imagine everything was just like, oh, do you still want to come? Do you still want to come and hang out with Charles? And if it was planned for when the Queen was alive, I'm sure there was an element of it being South Africa and it being the Queen's 70th year on the throne, which linked very nicely with her whole, oh, I'll serve you for the rest of my life speech thing that she did in South Africa, which they brought up 47,000 times.
Yeah, they really like that anecdote, don't they? We'll get to that bit. The visit started off. He was greeted at the airport by some guy whose name I can't remember, but he wasn't royal, so we're not going to talk about him. And then they had their official greeting in terms of the royal family from William and Kate, who this is the president of South Africa, whose name I didn't write down.
Cyril Ramaphosa, I believe it's pronounced. His first name is definitely Cyril. I've got that one.
He was greeted by William and Kate and escorted to Horse Guards Parade, where he was then formally welcomed by King Charles and Queen Camilla. And I think this was the first kind of immediately notable thing, because previously it tended to be Charles and Camilla who picked up the president or the head of state from wherever it was, took them to Horse Guards Parade, and they met the Queen there. So they're kind of, I suppose, updating it. Now that Charles and Camilla are King and Queen, the new heirs and consort are the ones doing the escorting. So it's the first time, I think, that they've done this.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting because I think there's always been that kind of complaint before that William and Kate should do more in terms of state visits. And people have compared them with, you know, places like Norway and Sweden and been like, oh, well, look what Victoria does. Look what Hakon does. And it was really interesting because I was like, oh, this is what Victoria and Hakon do. But they were the heirs, and now these are the heirs, and now they're doing it. So I never quite made the connection before that the kind of greeting of new guests, so we say that of the visitors, was always done by the heir, because I was like, well, it's done by Charles, it's done by Victoria, and they're completely different. But now it does make more sense.
I was one of those people who was always like, oh, they're not doing enough for state visits. And I still, to a degree, think that's true. But I also think, you know, as members of the public watching it, we think about, well, they haven't done much in the last 5 years or whatever. Whereas to the royals, they're like, well, we're going to be doing this for the next 50 years. So if we don't do this particular part of the job for the first 10, that's fine, because we're going to be doing it for years and years after that. So like, to us, it might be like, well, they're not doing enough. But to the royals, it was probably, well, it's appropriate for it to be the heir who does this job. And, you know, we couldn't guarantee that that would continue with the Queen's reign. Like, maybe the Queen just wanted, I'll have Charles pick these people up and come and drop them off with me. And then Charles might have been like, you know what, I really think that Anne should do this for some reason. But it seems that that's continuing, and it would be in line with other royal families. And I think, yeah, it does show that perhaps this whole time, the reason that William and Kate weren't doing that part of the state visit or other parts of the state visit is not because they didn't want to. It was because it was seen as being like, well, they're one step below, so they don't need to be doing it right now. And maybe that was their view and why they didn't do as much till now.
Yes. I can see the view, and I think there's an element to it. And at the same time, I'm also like, do more.
Mm. And then after that, they all kind of went to a lunch at Buckingham Palace, and they viewed an exhibition of objects in the royal collection, which is a standard part of a state visit. They always do that. I was worried about it, though, I'll be honest. There are a lot of things that are probably in the royal collection from South Africa that maybe didn't get there in the best way. Now, I don't know for sure, because I don't have an extensive knowledge of what's in the royal collection, but it's been built up over decades and over generations. And so I imagine there are some things from South Africa in that collection that are contested, that were outright stolen. And I was really worried that they were going to be like, look at this thing that this, I don't know, necklace that was taken from South Africa, or that was given as a gift to Queen Victoria completely of their own free will. They definitely weren't forced to do it. It was totally free, you know, and that it was going to be something that was going to potentially cause controversy. But from what I've read, it seems like they did choose things that were appropriate. So like there was a ton of gifts from Mandela. Made, obviously he made those freely because he was the democratically elected head of state, very modern, and he had, it reminds people of his friendship with the Queen. Or there was things that were like drawings that were done by royals when they visited South Africa, so it was their work, based on the fact that they'd been in South Africa, rather than something that was produced by South African people and stolen. So I was really worried, to be honest, before that happened, that they were going to be really tone deaf and choose things that were connected to South Africa, but not necessarily viewed by South Africans the same way a British person might view them. But they didn't seem to do that. So
well done, well done, Palace. Yeah, they did a lot of like pictures of them, you know, like you said, in South Africa, like, oh, this was my mom, this was me, that's my dad. Remember Mandela? My mom and him got on so well. But everyone seemed to like looking at the pictures. Like when we saw the footage, no one was, you know, when they do things like this normally and everyone looks a bit bored. I think the fact that it was just pictures of things they quite liked. They were like, oh, look at that. I remember that moment. I've seen that on TV.
Yeah. So I was glad that they did it that way. I mean, it's a low bar, really, isn't it? But and then the president did do some other things, but I didn't write any notes because there was no royals.
No, I only wrote a few notes on the things he did on the second day because I didn't care, but I thought I need to mention it. But I didn't write any notes until we get to the banquet because I didn't care.
Yeah. So then the next big thing, obviously, that happened was the state banquet, which was attended by Charles and Camilla, William and Kate, Sophie and Edward, the Earl and Countess of Wessex, the Duke and Duchess of Gloucester, and the Duke of Kent. So I think that's interesting to think about because there had been a lot of speculation beforehand that they would dramatically scale it back and it would just be maybe Charles and Camilla, William and Kate, Sophie and Edward. I think Anne and Tim were in the Falklands, I think, still.
Yes. Yeah, they were.
Yeah. I don't know if we can necessarily draw many conclusions from this, because I sort of feel like they did most of the planning before the Queen died. And so this is almost like the last state visit of the Queen's reign rather than the firsts of Charles. I think the first bit, they had to change that because Charles and Camilla couldn't pick them up and then introduce them to themselves. That makes no sense. So they had to change that bit. But I do feel like this guest list, maybe it is what Charles wants and this is how it's going to be going forward. But it might also be that this was what the Queen wanted. So I don't know if we can draw any conclusions one way or another. And the fact that Anne and Tim couldn't be there meant that they were one couple down already. So I guess they kind of almost needed the Gloucesters and the Duke of Kent to kind of bump up the numbers a little bit.
I'm very interested. I saw a lot of people before the state banquet being like, oh, I wonder if Princess Beatrice will be there. And I was like, well, no, she's not going to be there because she's just a person who happens to be related to someone there. That's not how it works.
Yeah.
But the kind of, you have obviously the Gloucesters, the Duke of Kent, and Princess Alexandra are all kind of still working royals. And even then you have people like the Duchess of Kent who aren't working royals anymore but who have still been working royals in the past. So I think they've got this kind of big group of very old people to choose from if they ever need to bump up numbers. But at the same time, when, you know, if they've got the full royal party kind of there, if you've got Charles and Camilla and William and Kate and Edward and Sophie and Anne and Tim, whether you need all these other royals to bump up the numbers is, you know, up for debate. So I think it will be interesting, and I think it would be interesting depending on the country, because I think South Africa, like you said, they were being very careful not to have a disastrous PR moment in the middle of Charles's first official state visit as the monarch. Whereas if it was France or, you know, Spain, it could have, you know, cut back a bit.
Yeah, it might be the case that this is just how he's going to handle this one. It might be the case that it's kind of left over from the Queen, and like the Duke of Gloucester had already got his outfit ready, so, you know, they wanted him there. Or maybe it's because they were involved in the second day, and so they wanted them to be there for the first day as well. And then the Duke of Kent is just like, well, if the Duke of Gloucester gets to go, then I get to go. That's not fair. Who knows? Maybe that's what happened. So I don't know if we can necessarily draw any conclusions. I'm going to be honest. I think Kate... it was her first one as Princess of Wales, and she looked terrified.
Yeah, the first picture I saw, I thought was photoshopped. And I don't know whether it's because we just don't have HQ photos of Kate in a tiara apart from on her wedding day, but it looked so weird. Not so much when they were sat down, but when they were kind of walking in, she looked like a deer in the headlights, and the tiara just looked like it. Someone just painted it on at the end. And I was at the theatre, I was watching The Mousetrap, and I was looking at the interval, and I only had like a glance at it, and I thought, I was spent the entire second act being like, so that was a photoshopped one, so I wonder what the real outfit looks
like. Yeah, definitely. I think, I mean, everybody looks a little bit nervous, I guess because it's the first one without the Queen. But I did just notice that she looked terrified. I mean, I always find her facial expressions at state banquets quite entertaining, because she often looks quite bored, and I feel like it's not in a bad way necessarily. She's not falling asleep or anything, but it is quite boring to sit down with a bunch of people you don't know and be sort of have a camera on you and be wearing an uncomfortable tiara and an uncomfortable dress, and like the whole thing doesn't sound like it's exactly a barrel of laughs. But this was her first, well, it wasn't her first time on the top table, but it was her first time in a while on the top table, and she was seated right next to the president. And she's the Princess of Wales now. So like, and it's this potentially sensitive state visit that comes after not a fairly controversial tour of the Caribbean, which kind of has some similar history and issues that between them as South Africa and Britain would. So I can understand why, but it's almost endearing, I suppose, that she looked quite scared. Let's get onto the fashion tiaras then, which I suppose is the big part. So, I mean, I had a couple of things that I noted generally before getting into anyone specifically. So firstly, no new family orders. So if you don't know, the royal family order is kind of, it's an order, which basically just means it's a badge that is given to women of the royal family based on the monarch's discretion. In Britain, the Queen was notoriously stingy, and like Kate had to wait ages to get hers. And the tradition is that you wear all of the royal family orders that you have, so they will continue to wear the Queen's one for as long as Charles decides that they should wear that. That's always been the tradition, but we were all wondering, like, is there going to be an order from Charles, because he will probably introduce one at some point and give that to some women. I think it kind of goes back to this thing of this being the last one of this Queen's reign rather than really the first of Charles's. It is the first of Charles's, but it's sort of not at the same time. And I feel like I'm not surprised. I was partly surprised because I wanted to see what his color would be, because they're always they change the color of the ribbon. But I also wasn't surprised because it is quite a quick turnaround, and he hasn't had a lot to do over the last few months or so. So that was the first thing that I noticed. I did see a lot of the press being like, this is done as a symbol of everybody's love for the Queen and as a nice, and it's like, no, I mean, I'm sure they do love the Queen and it was nice that they got to keep wearing it, but it is tradition that they always wear the ones that they have from other reigns. It's not like a special gesture for the Queen.
Yeah, like Princess Alexandra has some old tiaras, like not tiaras, old orders going on from like long deceased kings because of the amount of reigns she's been alive for. I didn't expect to see Charles's order. I wanted to see it because I want to know if he's going to go for the blue ribbon and then throw William off when he gets to his, because they can't have two blue ones in a row. Or if he's got another colour he's going to pick out. Because they're all very like pastel, like there's a really, like, obviously the Queen's is yellow and there's like pastel pink and pastel green. Are we going to get like another pastel, or is he just going to be like, neon orange is my shade? and it's going to look like an eyesore.
Yeah, William doesn't know colours other than blue.
Yeah, he has to have a blue one.
Yeah, I can see him going with like a deep blue, which I almost hope he does, because the royal family order, it's in Sweden, again, not to mention Sweden but all the time, but they are my favourites and I know the most about them, but they have the Order of the Seraphim and they have the Royal Family Order, and the Royal Family Order is in the same colour as the Order of the Seraphim. So all you have to do when you are picking an outfit or a tiara is match a pale blue, which is quite easy to do. Whereas with the British Royal Family, they often will have a sash that's like the Order of the Garter or the Royal Victorian Order or whatever, which is dark blue. Or they'll have the sash of whatever country is visiting potentially, which might be a completely different color. And then they have potentially multiple Royal Family Orders, but they'll at least have one that's going to be yellow. And then they'll have maybe Charles's. And if he goes with blue, then they'll have blue. If he goes to green, they'll have green. And then that means that they just have loads of colors that they have to coordinate with. So it's why they always end up wearing white, really.
Yeah, I always think it's really interesting because for like the end of her reign, the queen always wore white. And then Kate tends to go for the kind of pale colors for big tiara events. And she did even before she had orders. But like in the early days of the queen's reign, she didn't wear these kind of white outfits. And I was very interested to see if they were going to kind of all stick with the pale colours or if there'd be brighter colours, because they always kind of took their lead from the Queen. Mm. And when she started wearing pale, everyone was like, oh, I'm going to wear blush. Or I'm going to wear ivory.
Yeah.
It's like, where is my colour scheme? Yeah. Come on.
Where's the pattern? Like, where's, give me something.
Where's the florals?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's still to be seen. Maybe at the next one we'll have some, and then we'll have the whole headache of like who's gonna get it, and oh, he hasn't given it to this person, so that means he hates them, and everyone, you know, look forward to that.
Imagine if Charles doesn't give Edward and Sophie the Duke and Duke Edinburgh title and doesn't give Sophie the order. It's gonna be great. I need that to happen.
I know, it's always made into such a drama. Like the Queen had no logic for why she seemed to give them to people when she did. Just seemed to be like whenever she felt like it. But we didn't find that out now. So that's still another mystery of Charles's reign that we've got to wait for. And then the other sort of general observation that I had was I saw a few things beforehand of like, these are some jewels that are in the royal family's collection that are connected to South Africa that some of them could wear. And there was like a diamond suite with like a necklace and things. And I am really, really glad that nobody wore that because they're a little bit dubious.
Yeah, I think there's such a risk. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the lead up to the coronation about a certain crown that Camilla could wear with a certain jewel in it. And a lot of people going, oh, it will be fine. It's a long time ago. Oh, and this one person from India said they didn't care, so it's fine.
Yeah.
I think if they'd come out in South African jewellery that wasn't, you know, what it isn't clear was a free gift given with pure intentions, it would have set them off on a really bad foot, because we were like, wow, look how bad this is. People, you know, they're just wearing these colonial jewels from this era and they don't care about the South Africa and they're rubbing the president's face in it. Even if, you know, that I'm sure that wouldn't have been their intention if they did wear them, they would have been like, oh, that's a nice nod. But it would have also made me very concerned about the future in terms of their choices and jewellery and clothes.
But yeah, more specifically, let's do a rundown of the main outfits. So Camilla wore a blue dress.
And she looked lovely.
Yeah. It was had lace sleeves, which I'm very excited about because after, how long? Almost 9 years of arguing with people about royal protocol and about you know, what royals are allowed to wear, I just love that Camilla came out at the first state banquet with sheer lace sleeves. Like, we're in the new era of royal protocol where a state banquet you're allowed to wear sheer lace sleeves. Like, this is, it's a free-for-all, wear what you want. Hot pants,
shoulders slightly visible.
Yeah, goodness, call the church elders. Yeah, so, you know, she looked very nice, but I think the big thing was that she wore a new to her tiara, which was the Queen's sapphire tiara. And I honestly wasn't sure. I mean, as Queen, she now has access to a ton of extra tiaras. I wasn't sure which way it would go, really. But she is such a great tiara wearer.
Yeah, she's got she's got grey hair for a start.
Great hair.
And also she like, it's a bit like Maxima. They've got the personality to fit a tiara, which not every royal has. And I think I've never seen her look bad in a tiara.
Yeah, me neither. These big tiaras, you can't really have like a sleek updo kind of thing going on. You have to have a bit of volume to the hair. And Camilla always gives us volume, so she can wear these gigantic tiaras and they just really, really suit her. And she also, like, she has a blue sash, blue dress. So wearing sapphires with it was kind of, it tied it all together, which meant that she was able to get around the difficulties of wearing an outfit that matches all these bajillion colours they've got going on without just wearing white, which was nice.
I personally think Camilla should, for every time she has to wear a tiara from now on, just wear a different one.
Yeah.
Just for fun, because it will just give me so much joy. But yeah, she wore blue earlier in the day as well, when she kind of greeted the president of South Africa at Horse Guards. Really bright blue. And it kind of, like, the blue from earlier was like the same shade as the sashes. So she wore like a darker blue, which matched the sapphires. So all tied in together very well. Like you said, the tiara, I have seen it before on the Queen. I've never looked at it because in my head it was ugly, but I looked at it on Camilla and I was like, actually, it's quite an intricately interesting tiara. I quite like it.
Yeah, it's not my favourite because it's a bit pointy.
Yeah,
and we've talked about this a lot, about neither of us are that massive fans of pointy tiaras. But I do think that it's a very nice tiara. It's not my least favourite at all. It's just not my favourite either. Thank you to Camilla for giving us this era of new protocol with the racy lace sleeves and brand new tiara. And just everything we could have hoped for.
Camilla set the bar high.
Yeah, she has. So moving on to Kate. Oh, we will post pictures in the description of the episode. So if you haven't seen these things, then you can go and have a look there. That's mostly directed towards my mother. Because she doesn't follow royal stuff, so she has no idea what we're talking about when we talk about fashion. But she wore a Jenny Packham gown and got a rapturous response from people about how incredibly gorgeous and wonderful it was. And look, I love a cape gown. Everybody knows I love capes. So anything that I would have, it immediately gets like 3 extra points just for being a cape. But I really just don't like Jenny Packham.
I was really waiting to hear what you thought of the cape dress after the gold one. I was like,
oh, yeah.
Ooh. What's Jessica going to think about this one?
I just have this aversion to Jenny Packham, and I'm really sorry to people who really like her stuff. Some of my favourite gowns from sort of 2011, 2012 were Jenny Packham. But taking a basic silhouette and smacking some sequins on it does not make a great dress. And it was almost too much up the top. I don't know if that makes sense, but it all felt very clustered around the top of, like, this is too much sequin. This is a gorgeous dress for
a gala.
Yeah, a gala, like Earthshot. But it, with all of the diamonds and all of the orders and everything sort of concentrated up at the top of the gown, it just made it look very top heavy and then a really boring bottom.
I actually agree. I didn't love the gown. I like the shape of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually really like the colour, because Kate doesn't actually wear bright white very often. Mm. And I think it made the entire look really fresh. And I think a lot of Kate's state banquet looks and tiara looks can look a little bit kind of old and stuffy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite new and it looked fresh, but I didn't like the sequins. And I think if it hadn't had everything else, she'd been at a premiere or a gala and she didn't have the tiaras and the orders and the great big earrings, and she had all the sequins, it would have been great, because you would have had that bit of sparkle. I think because she had the tiara and because she had the order over the shoulders and the cape over the shoulders and the family order and the Art Deco brooch and the earrings, it was too much going on. And I just watched her be like, get rid of all the stuff and just have a cape gown. And I did like it. I think she looked great, but it wasn't my favourite dress.
I have stronger views on things because I'm contrary, I guess. And like, the more people are like, this is the greatest gown that's ever existed, she looks incredible, she's perfect, wonderful, beautiful. I'm like, really? This gown? Are you sure? And I overcompensate and I'm like more critical of it because everyone else seems to love it. And I don't see that. I do think she looked beautiful. I do think the gown is gorgeous. I would wear it in a heartbeat. I think in a different occasion, if she brings it back for something else, she doesn't really repeat her state bank accounts that often, but if she did, I would probably love it a lot in a different context. But yeah, I think Queen Mathilde, a few days later in Belgium, she wore a cape gown for the state banquet from Switzerland. And what she did was she had her sash kind of stop at the top of the dress rather than going over the cape. And Kate's did go over the cape, which meant that she then had to attach it with a brooch, which was kind of awkward to have that brooch on top of all of the sparkles. So I don't know whether maybe it would have looked better if she'd had the sash stop on the dress.
I will give it credit because I don't like the Lover's Knot tiara. I've never liked it because I think it's really boring. But this is the first time I've liked it. And I think it's because the gown was, I mean, it probably wasn't that bright. It's probably camera flash, but it looks so bright and just like crisp. It really made the tiara, like, because it's pearls, it made the tiara look stunning.
Well, I do not have the same hatred of the Lover's Knot. I do like it as a tiara. I think it's very pretty. I like pearls. It's quite rounded. It's not so pointy. So I'm quite, and I think it looks very good on Kate. It really suits her. I'm always like, ugh, whenever she wears it, just because, well, partly because she always wears it. But also it always gets referred to as like Diana's tiara. Even though it wasn't given to Diana, she just wore it. But I every time Kate wears it, especially if she's also, you know, now she's actually Princess of Wales and she wore the Princess of Wales brooch earlier that day. It's kind of like, it was a bit of overkill of sort of Princess Diana and Kate. Kate is channeling Princess Diana sort of vibes, which I always find really tiresome. But yeah, I think all in all, it was good, but not as good as everyone seems to think it was.
Yeah, she looked beautiful, but yes. I did not love it. I liked the dress.
Yeah.
I did not love it. And that's the problem because I'm fussing.
I wrote down for Sophie, Sophie's in the aquamarine tiara, boring. Dress was also boring. That's all I've written.
I wrote Sophie was also there and then in question mark, green.
Yeah. It was the most boring dress. Yeah.
So boring.
And she was wearing a tiara that she's worn a bunch of times, the aquamarine tiara, which is, I mean, she doesn't have a good selection. I feel sorry for her because both of her tiaras are pretty ugly. But it was incredibly boring.
I wanted her to wear her wedding tiara again because they've like, she updated it.
Yeah.
And we've only seen it in really blurry pictures. And I don't actually think it looked very good updated. I don't think it looked any better than it did beforehand.
I think it looked better, but not good.
Yeah, I'd like to see it again. But no, she went back for the aquamarine. And then I had to deal with people being like, cost of living crisis. Kate's worn this new dress, but Sophie hasn't. She's worn an old tiara. And I was like, no one cares. No one in the pub, no one starving on the street is going, how dare Kate wear a new gown to a state banquet? Like, that is not how people function. And I was getting really annoyed.
Yeah, if Kate wears a repeated gown, that doesn't make me any richer, ultimately. So there is a sensitivity issue. You know, you don't want to be flaunting wealth in people's faces. But I also think that on the flip side of that, if Kate had worn a repeated boring gown for the state visit from South Africa, would people have then said, oh, well, she didn't go all out for South Africa. She didn't view them the same way as she did all of the other visits where she wore new gowns. They kind of got a basic repeat that we don't care about. Like, she didn't put much effort into this visit from South Africa. Whereas, you know, so maybe people would have said that. I think people would have found a reason to criticize if they wanted to, regardless. There was a speech which King Charles gave, which was interesting. So he started off with saying welcome in, I think, 6 or 7 different South African languages. And I mean, okay, I don't know much about President Cyril. I did read a couple of things about maybe some corruption and all those things. So if I'm saying something that is controversial to any South African people listening, like if I'm praising somebody I shouldn't be, I am really, really sorry. I genuinely do not know anything about his politics, but he was adorable. Because he was so impressed by Charles's terrible South African dialect. Like, he kept saying wow over and over, and I was just, it was very sweet.
Yeah, it's one of those things that is so easy to do, and it's such a good move. But Cyril was having the best time.
Always a crowd pleaser. You would think by now people wouldn't be that impressed with the fact that they just use Google Translate to find out what hello is in a South African dialect, but apparently it still works. And then I'm not going to read the entire speech, but basically there was kind of a call back to the Queen and her 21st birthday speech and her friendship with Mandela, which was kind of, it was smart, I think, because it was, those were sweet anecdotes that were relevant because they were about South Africa. But it was also a very subtle way of going, look, Mandela liked us. And if Mandela liked us, then you should like us too.
Mandela's just such a, I don't think he's such a good win because it feels very mean to Mandela, but he is such a good win when he did get on very well with the Queen, very famously, and loves just, you know, was very positive towards the royal family. And he's so beloved, I think, across both South Africa and the UK.
Yeah, definitely. It was like, it is honest. Like, they weren't lying about the relationship between the Queen and Mandela. They did get on really, really well. And by all accounts, she was actually very supportive of the end of apartheid and was very integral in getting South Africa to be welcomed back into the international community after apartheid ended. And that's why she had a good relationship with Mandela. But it also was very, like, strategic. And then they did kind of very, or he did very briefly address the kind of historic relationship. He referred to the profound sorrow, but of course did not apologize. And you can go and see episode 16 for a much more detailed conversation about why royals don't apologize for the historic relationships that they have with different countries. Both Grace and I think when we talked in episode 16, we're both supportive of there being an apology at some point, but it isn't the royals' individual decisions. But I am still glad they acknowledged it, even if they have to sort of stop short of what some people might want.
Yeah, I didn't know if Charles was going to acknowledge it, particularly because it is his first speech. And I think he did it in the right way as well, when he was like, he used words like sorrow, and he said it was wrong. He said, I'm acknowledging the wrong. He didn't say I'm sorry for them, like you said. He didn't apologise because he can't, but he didn't go, oh, and obviously, you know, recollections may vary.
Yeah. Nice.
There were wrongs, and we have to be aware of that. We have to acknowledge them.
If you're a South African person or anybody from like Jamaica or Barbados or wherever, if you're listening and you're not impressed, that's fine. Like, I get that. I don't think people should be impressed by the fact that he acknowledged that, you know, slavery was bad or apartheid was bad. You know, like, I don't think that that's a astonishing achievement. But at the same time, there are limits to what they can do. And I think within the limits that they have, he did the best job that he could to at least acknowledge it. And then it kind of was rounded up with a reference to Desmond Tutu, which is again a very subtle link because he was very beloved across the world, not just in South Africa, and also was a member of the Anglican Church. So nice little tie to Charles, who is now the head of the Church of England.
As speeches go, I think state banquet speeches are always and normally very dry, and they tend to be, you know, oh, here's an anecdote about, especially when it was the Queen, here's an anecdote about your great-grandfather who we used to hang out with, and that's it. There was a lot of sort of elements of those kind of easy PR wins in Charles's speech with enough substance to kind of keep it going.
I did think some bits were a little bit clunky. So like, there was a random sporting mention where we talked about how South Africa did well in some sport thing, the women's team, I think, and then the Lionesses in England did well. And I was like, okay, but they're not connected. So I don't know why you, but we both have women who are good at sports. Like, okay, great. So there were some bits that were felt a little bit clunky to me, but I think overall it was a safe speech that kind of played to a format that they know works, and also spoke about South Africa as being like a partner rather than this passive recipient of kind of British benevolence and kindness and like, oh, isn't it nice that we've invited South Africa in? It was like, South Africa is a major country with an economy, you know, we want to work with them and we see them as a partner. So that was kind of the vibe I got from the speech overall. So it wasn't groundbreaking, but that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, it did the job very well.
So then day two, my notes are extremely short. Mostly the president was accompanied by Prince Edward. They went to the Royal Botanic Gardens. They went to the Francis Crick Institute, which is kind of like a science center.
Yep, I didn't make any notes apart from my usual, doesn't Edward look like William?
And so what you'll see here is that, like, Charles Camilla, I mean, Charles did say goodbye to him, but sort of Charles Camilla, William, Kate didn't really do a great deal on day two compared to day one, which is in keeping with the kind of Queen's approach to things, in that Edward would, or somebody like that, like Anne, or, you know, they would have been the one, Andrew back in the day, would have been the ones who accompanied the visitor on the second day to some of their things. I don't know if that's going to be the way forward, that the second day is still going to be carried out by these sort of more junior royals, or if this was just, you know, those were the people who already had it booked in their diary and William and Kate were busy on the second day, so couldn't have done anything anyway. I wouldn't read into the fact that Edward and the Gloucesters and more junior royals did the bulk of the work on day two. We'll have to see what happens for future state visits to see whether or not that's the approach that Charles is going to continue with.
Britain's in a really weird situation. Because in Norway, if there's a state visit, there are four royals, really, who can do anything. And then you go over to the UK, there's quite a big bunch of them. And, you know, you get to the Gloucesters, who are God knows what number in the line of succession, quite far down. But they've been doing the job for longer than some of the other royals have been alive. And I think they're also in a weird position where you've got these people like Edward, who's been a, you know, a working royal for 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
And that's the type of person that you would expect to see doing quite high profile things at a state dinner. But now he's the king's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a different relationship.
It is a difficult thing because on a practical level, it makes sense to make use of the people who you have. And also, I think the second day always tends to be things that are like science and business. That's why Andrew used to do it a lot, because those were his areas of interest. Obviously, he can't do that now, but Edward kind of, nobody really knows what he's interested in, so he can slot in quite nicely. But it maybe wouldn't be, some of the things they do, it wouldn't necessarily be Kate's area of interest. They're not going to be going to visit children, probably. So, you know, it makes sense to kind of use as many people as you have. But at the same time, I would maybe feel like, okay, well, I want to spend the day with people who matter.
Like, I want a proper, I also feel like if it's Anne, everyone's like,
yeah,
because she was the second oldest and there's such a big jump between Anne and Andrew. I feel like Charles and Anne, it was like, even though Charles is, you know, Anne is low down in the, you know, comparatively in the line of succession and all of that, like, oh, she's, you know, she's Anne, she's senior royal. But with Edward, she's like, it's Edward, it's not that important. It's not even a duke.
No. Well, he won't like that. So our second topic of the episode today is about Prince William and the Football Association. It is the World Cup, which I have no interest in. but there have been some questions about Prince William maintaining his role as president of the Football Association, which he's had for a while now, the governing body for English football, when he is Prince of Wales. I think people from the US, perhaps, which is a lot of our audience, I don't know if they'll necessarily understand. I know that people do play football or soccer over there, but I don't know that it's got the same cultural thing that it has. To the vast majority of the world, football is more than a sport. When countries compete to host events like the World Cup and things like that, it can have a pretty serious impact on their economic situation if they win or lose. And so I almost feel like holding a presidency of the Football Association is almost like pseudo-political. William occupying that role has definitely caused controversies for him in the past. So I've got a couple of examples. He's the president of the Football Association of the FA, so he casts the vote for who should host various things. And there was a competition for the 2023 Women's World Cup, and he voted in favour of Colombia and against Australia and New Zealand. And I'm sure that that's not a personal choice, but it is interesting that he will eventually be king of Australia and New Zealand and actively voted against something that could have been beneficial for them economically. And then the other situation is the English World Cup bid in 2009 and 2010. I think they were trying to get the 2022 one, which has gone to Qatar. So maybe it should have gone to England in the end, but they were unsuccessful. But a report that was released in 2017 found that Prince William and David Cameron, who was Prime Minister at the time, were in a conversation about a vote trading deal with a South Korean official, and that a South American official asked England officials, I don't think William specifically, but he was connected to them, to arrange a knighthood and an audience with the Queen to help secure that country's vote for England, which would have been illegal. And you can go and listen back to episode 13 to find out why that would have been illegal. But apparently William wasn't very happy with the whole thing at the time, because basically he was attached to this bid and he was a representative for this bid publicly, but a huge amount of what they expected him to do was to meet with the representatives of different football associations from across the world and kind of suck up to them and schmooze them.
It is like a religion. It's a really cultural thing. William, being a man who loves football and wants to work, do as much as he can within the sport of football, is fine. And I also think him, you know, he is English. He grew up English, and obviously, like, I support the England football team because I am English, and it would logically make sense that that's who his friends would support when he was growing up. And because of his position, he can do that at a higher level than, you know, most people can. But then, like you said, the football governing body are notoriously not great, and they're very corrupt. I think, you know, not to get sued by FIFA and the FA, but both of them are notoriously corrupt.
They're probably not listening.
if they were, they tuned in to find out what we thought. It makes sense for a member of the royal family to be heavily involved in something that means so much to not just English people, but to British people in general. But at the same time, it's such a tricky line to balance when the official governing bodies of those important cultural things are so corrupt, because you wouldn't want them to be like, oh, we're not involved, because people will be like, why not? There is an expectation that the royal family will support the England football team, or, you know, the football team, so they go off and do their football. But at the same time, it's that balance with, oh, but are you getting into bed with a criminal?
These are not just football clubs that are chatting to each other and, oh, isn't that nice, and they're playing each other. Like, these are almost political entities that kind of don't operate within the rules of politics. So they can have, well, you know, like, as I say, with the bid in 2010, William was in the room with the Prime Minister. So this was obviously an important thing for England. And he was there with representatives from the football associations of other nations. So in a way, this wasn't just a football club negotiating with another football club. This was England and its official representatives negotiating with an official representative from somewhere in South America or from South Korea. You know, this was a country talking to another country. So that becomes a bit of an issue beyond just like, oh, I like to tweet out that I support the England football team.
Yeah, and I think normally, you know, when we talk about royals and their patronages, a lot of royals are called the president of something, and it functions like a patronage.
Yeah,
like, it's just another word for it. And I don't think for a second that William is doing presidenty things for the FA. I'm sure it is a title, but it is different than your average patronage, because he has to put his name to these things, and because he is representing them, he's representing them in these pseudo political discussions rather than, you know, representing them, you know, at a gala. He's doing the other side of things as well. And, you know, I'm sure he's not sat there going, great, I'm going to vote for this guy, and I know the FA really want New Zealand to get it, but I am Team Colombia. But at the same time, if, you know, it is different from a normal patronage, because, you know, he's, what is he, president of some hospital? They're not going to ask him to vote on something like that.
Exactly. And if like Gary Lineker was the president of the Football Association, that shows you my cultural references for footballers. Gary Lineker, when was the last time he played football? If he was president of the FA, no one would really care, except from Australian and New Zealanders, maybe, would care that he was voting, he was doing the official vote against them hosting the World Cup. But because William will eventually be head of state of those countries, he is actively acting against their interests because of his allegiance to the English team. And that does just create a lot of problems, because he's potentially taking away a very important economic opportunity and cultural opportunity for this country.
I think the other problem is that William is a huge football fan. because he could have been the president of the FA and not done anything to do with it. But he is such a passionate football fan, and everyone knows, like, William likes football, like, that's part of who he is. He gets involved in things which can lead to these situations.
Of all of the positions that William holds, this is undoubtedly the one that is the most controversial and has got him in hot water the most times. Like, yeah, being the president of a cancer hospital has not really caused any controversy, surprisingly enough. Whereas this, you know, this is not the first time that his role has been talked about as potentially being inappropriate or opening him up to things that he could maybe avoid. And I will say again, before we get into Wales, I'm really sorry to Wales. I know we said at the beginning this was all about you, but it's so far it hasn't been at all. But I'm going to be honest, I'm really surprised that there hasn't been more backlash about him supporting the tournament when he has positioned himself as an LGBTQ plus ally.
I think because he isn't there, he's got away. Because there's a lot of people in the UK who are watching, who are going, oh, I'm not okay with the fact it's in Qatar. I'm against that. You know, I'm not supporting it. But they're still watching it because they still want to watch the football and they still want to see England play the games. And I think even in the general public's consciousness, William isn't associated with LGBT issues in the same way he would be for royal watchers. And I think that him not being in Qatar, but being like, oh, I support you before the tournament, and now he's not really said anything since it started, he kind of gets away with it a bit. Not, I'm not saying it's the right thing, but I am saying he's kind of, there are other people that the public are blaming, like the football teams themselves, for being there.
I'm surprised that there hasn't been at least like one think piece in The Guardian. I'm not surprised that people have not criticised him for enjoying the match, because a lot of people are, and he is president of the FA, so, you know, he kind of has to. But I am surprised that there hasn't been criticism of the fact that he hasn't said anything. Again, because going back to the South Africa thing, William can't say, isn't it terrible that Qatar are doing this? Because that would be against the limits of his role. He's not allowed to do that. But most of the public don't seem to care about the limitations and expect royals to be doing things that would be put them in an uncomfortable position all of the rest of the time. So I'm genuinely surprised that there has not been some articles in The Guardian about, like, why hasn't William said how bad it is in Qatar and kind of championed LGBTQ plus people, but he wants to be on the cover of their magazines, you know. So it's not that I think that there should be an outrage or that there shouldn't, or that's not for me to say, but I'm just surprised that there hasn't been, that hasn't, you know, this, the Welsh thing has really been the big focus.
But I also think it's going to be really funny if there's a think piece in The Guardian after we release this, and I will be suing.
Yeah. So the biggest one, we're finally onto the point of this bit, is that a lot of Welsh people have expressed anger that William is Prince of Wales, but will be very publicly supporting England because he is president of the Football Association. As a Scottish person, I do get the frustration, even though I'm not Welsh, I do get that frustration of knowing that if you played against England, he is always going to root for you to lose, even though he has a title that comes from your country.
My granddad is Welsh and my other granddad is Irish. So I feel like I did not necessarily grow up in a monarchist household.
Yes, fair enough.
But I think I understand it. And I know that the Prince of Wales title has always been a very problematic title, particularly in its kind of in its transition periods, when it swaps from one member to another, when it's given to a new person. But I also think there is ire, even, is aimed at the title and the title holder, who happens to be William, the president of the FA. But I think the fact that the World Cup is happening now, it's a platform to use to express that frustration, because even though they've been saying it since, you know, William was made Prince of Wales, they've not been a chance for them to say it on the public stage, so to speak. Whereas now they're like, aha, got one.
The real issue is not whether or not he supports Welsh football, because he was at one point Prince William of Wales. And that's not the same as being Prince of Wales, but it's still a title that you have because your father is the Prince of Wales, and it's designating you as being of Wales, despite the fact that you're not from Wales. And nobody really seemed to care when he was Prince William of Wales and also president of the FA and campaigning for England to host the World Cup and all that sort of stuff. What I think is it's really about Welsh people seeing this current time as a window to have the Prince of Wales title potentially removed, or to show their displeasure of the Prince of Wales title, and they're using it as an opportunity. And I'm not saying that in like a, oh, it's a, you know, they're opportunists or anything like that. It's smart. It's very smart. But I think, yeah, just be honest that, like, I don't think most Welsh people actually care if William supports their team or not. What they care about is the fact that he has this Prince of Wales title while not supporting their team.
Possibly a controversial opinion. I don't like Michael Sheen. He gives me really dodgy vibes.
Oh, I like him. I find him really charming.
I find it really hard when he says something that I kind of agree with, because my natural instinct is to be like, well, you're wrong. His kind of initial statement on it was about the Prince of Wales not supporting the Welsh national team. He kind of said something like that. And that's what the papers ran with. And then he was like, no, my issue wasn't the national team part. It was the Prince of Wales. But like, you need to focus on the actual issue here if you're going to sort of listen. If you're going to take my word, you have to listen to what I'm saying.
I do not disagree at all. I don't really have anything to kind of counteract that argument. I think it's perfectly fair. I will say, I wrote a whole rant. I don't apologize, but if you are an individual who likes watching football, this is not directed at you, because there are lots of people who have very fond memories of football and who really love it, and it's a positive thing in their community or whatever. And like, I'm not directing this towards you. I'm just talking about my own personal feelings. I think football is an awful sport. I think it's divisive and awful. To me, football is linked to sectarianism and violence. Like, growing up in Scotland, I associate it with racism. So the abuse of players like Marcus Rashford, you know, if you don't score a goal and you happen to be a black person, you're going to get racist death threats. It's linked to domestic violence. So domestic abuse increases by 40% when the English national team lose a match. And that is actually not the case in rugby. If the English national team in rugby loses a match, there's no discernible increase. So this is something about football culture that lends itself to violence. And so to me, whether he supports Wales, whether he supports England, like, I agree with what the Welsh people are saying and I agree with it in principle, but I honestly can't make myself care about which team he supports when I personally just only associate that sport with violence and divisiveness and hatred. And I'm not saying this to people so that they stop watching football or they feel ashamed of watching football. Like, if you enjoy it and it's positive to you, that's absolutely fantastic. That's my rant.
I love it. I don't care that William loves football. And also, I can say that as the president of the FA, the English Football Association, he is going to support England. That's his job. He's also the patron of Welsh rugby, so he supports Welsh rugby teams. And he said that in his little visit to Wales, the Welsh Parliament, the other day. He was like, well, I support English football, but I support Welsh rugby. Like, that's my thing. There is a logic to doing it that way. Like, no one's kicked up a fuss about him not supporting Australia's national team at the World Cup, who are also there, you know, and Canada are there. You know, that no one's, you know, complained about that. But at the same time, okay, and maybe this is just my Michael Sheen hatred speaking, but I get the Prince of Wales issue. I get that the people of Wales and the people of Cornwall in particular and they're both areas with huge nationalist identities. Like, Wales and Cornish people are very independent and nationalist, and, you know, want to be their own people. They don't want to be governed by London. Like, no one in Cambridge is sat there like, how dare they give me, you know, because it doesn't matter. There's not that sense of pride in being from Cambridge as there is from being from Scotland or Wales or Cornwall.
Can you imagine a Cambridge separatist movement?
It would be very fancy, very posh. But I get those issues, and I think those are topics that should be discussed, because if William is the Prince of Wales, which he is, does that mean he should, you know, spend more time in Wales, do more work in Wales? Why did this man not learn Welsh when he knew he was probably going to be Duke of Wales, Prince of Wales one day? Like, that's a sensible thing for him to have done. But then you kind of get into the sort of the nitty gritty of it, and he is the Prince of Wales, but he's also, you know, what is he in Scotland, like Baron? No, what is it, Baron? He's the Duke of Rothesay and Earl of Strathern. Yeah, he's got two titles. Like, if the Scottish national team were playing, would that also be an issue? Like, is there an issue because he's got, you know, an Irish title? Is there an issue that he is the future head of state for New Zealand and for Australia and for Canada? Like, if you, he's a human, he can't, every time there's a sporting event, be like, big fan of England, big fan of Wales, big fan of New Zealand, big fan of Jamaica, big, you know, because that's just impractical. And I mean, the logical answer was to be William to be stepped down as the president of the FA, and he can still support football. But I also think William's not going to do that because this is probably his, like, one passion that he gets to do as a job.
If you look at, there are other examples of this happening. So if you look at Crown Prince Frederick in Denmark, he was a member of the International Olympic Committee. And that was incredibly controversial because he was, again, it's kind of this pseudo political thing. And it's also very corrupt. And in 2021, after a criticism, because he voted against, well, like, for example, things like he voted against the government of Denmark's wishes as a member of the IOC, he had to step down from that role because it was seen as being inappropriate. So there are there's precedents in other countries of, like, taking on a sort of pseudo-political sporting role can get you in a lot of trouble. And I do think it's a difficult position because William stepping down, if he's not replaced by another royal, even a junior royal who's, like, the cousin, married to the cousin of somebody, that would be breaking about 70 years of tradition of having a member of the royal family be the president of the FA. And you know, there are alternatives, but I don't even know if Edward likes football, and I don't know if the Football Association would be thrilled about downgrading from Prince William to Edward. sorry, again, this has been a very anti-Edward episode, but sorry. I also think he was given the Prince of Wales title incredibly quickly, and I mean, I don't know how things go privately, but I don't know if he necessarily could have said, sorry, Charles, but I don't want this thing that you're offering to me. So I kind of feel like he is in a very difficult position because he took this role on as a royal tradition, but he also has this other thing that he kind of doesn't really have much choice over whether he has, and it's put him in a difficult position. I think his approach has been as good as it can be. So he has acknowledged the situation. He said he supports Wales if they're playing other teams. And he has sent things to the Welsh team to say good luck. And so he's done little bits. So I think his approach, yeah, has been as good as it can be in this difficult situation he finds himself in, but it's not going to go away.
Yeah, I almost feel like what they kind of want to do is split the president role into, like, two co-presidents, and you have the political one and you have the William one. Like you said, he's done the best he can do. He's tweeting in Welsh or the Welsh team play and, you know, all of that. But then I'm just like, well, how can Welsh get, you know, how come Wales gets the special treatment? Because he's not the president of the Welsh FA. But what about Australia, like, and Canada? They're also there. He has the same relationship technically to them because the Prince of Wales title, it's an extra title, but it doesn't mean anything.
No, he doesn't have any control over Wales.
Yeah, it's like Duke of Cambridge. You know, it's special in the fact that it was given to him and not hereditary, but it's not any more special than the fact he is one day going to also be head of state of these other countries. So I feel like, and I don't want to say, like, we should all be complaining at William, because I don't think it's his fault. But I think that if we are going to, and not we, Michael Sheen, I'm not blaming you personally, but if there is going to be a big push against, you know, William not supporting Wales, and then he starts supporting Wales, what about the other 16, 17 countries that he also has these links to and doesn't publicly support? And I think, in one hand, it completely opens up a ton of worms about having a British head of state in all these other countries, which is a bit too much for a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, we've talked about that before, it's fine.
But, you know, I think in terms of titles, I understand why the Welsh, yeah, some Welsh people do not like the fact there is a Prince of Wales. I do not think the Prince of Wales, William handled the fact that he clearly knew at some point in his life he was going, yeah, to be Prince of Wales and didn't do anything about it until he turned 40. It was a complete oversight.
So thank you, everybody, for joining us for this episode of the On Air podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please do rate us 5 stars. We greatly appreciate praise, so respond well to praise. And other than that, it is a goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.